I didn't want anyone to control my destiny. I was 39 at the time. I'm 41 now. I didn't want anyone to take away what we'd built, especially because a lot of the people that came to Hollywell were from the big firms. They didn't want to go back to those firms because they quite like what we'd built for people and supporting. Not to say those, I love PwC, let's be clear. I'm not one of those people that vents about their big four firm. There's nowhere else I was going to get that training.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Mark German from Hollywell Partners, and we are going to have a chat about due diligence, quality of earnings. What are they? Why are they important? And also how Mike managed to sell his own firm, a fractional CFO's firm, to a PE firm as well, which is an unusual achievement. But before we get stuck into that, Mike, you're very welcome to the podcast. Maybe you could just open up by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Thanks for having me, James. So although I am a Yank, as you would call me, I am a very avid Liverpool Football Club supporter. I grew up wanting to be Michael Owen. Clearly, I was not Michael Owen, but if anyone remembers, he was the last English Ballon d'Or winner, I believe, and someone I aspire to be. And of course, they've gotten good sense, but were pretty crap most of my adult and childhood.
I remember Michael Owen was in that era of English soccer that English people seem to think was amazing, but actually they won hardly anything.
Nothing.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I know you seem to know a lot more about soccer than I do, even though you're a Yank. I don't know if Yank is a pejorative term. I feel like No.
Having lived and worked in both Europe and the United States, I don't take offense to it anyway.
Okay. All right. Sometimes people call me a paddy and I'm always 50-50 about it anyway. Yeah. So you've done a couple of very interesting things along your career, including we're going to get to at the end how you managed to build up and sell your own fractional CFO firm to a PE firm. So I'm going to ask about that in particular. But maybe you could just bring us back to, you started off in the Air Force and tell us a bit about your background from there on.
Yeah, sure. So guys, I was an Air Force captain turned PwC director in the SEC audit space. So large public company audit financials through to the deal practice, taking companies public and back to private between New York and London markets. Well, I lived and worked in a lot of cities between Miami, New York, London, did deals in Africa, China, India. And then eventually moved back to the States as we started to have and grow a little bit of a family. And that's when I made the ridiculously terrifying leap to start Hollywell and would highly recommend it to anybody else.
Very good. So if you were high flying in Price Waterhouse, it's pretty much a dead cert. You're going to do pretty well in life if you manage to stay there beyond the first, say, five or so years. That's the thing. They try and burn everyone off, burn all the recruitments off early, see who's left standing. And if you're still standing, you're set. What made you walk away from that sort of all that security and easy life, let's call it? What was missing?
Yeah, and for anyone who doesn't know, James interned there a long time ago. But I grew up at PwC. I'd only had two jobs to that point, the military and then PricewaterhouseCoopers. Quite loved it, never thought I would leave. And then when they asked us to move to Houston from London, my wife finally said, look, we've moved a lot of places for you and for your career. Can we go back to family a little bit? And that was it. She'd made the call. I did one more busy season for them. And then I didn't want to get recruited. I didn't want to go into the private industry yet, or at least I didn't think about it. Mm-hmm. And I thought if there was ever a time I was going to start my own shop, even if it failed tremendously, I could look back and say I took a bit of a risk, and that was where Hollywell was born.
Okay, so I guess the answer I heard there was you didn't decide, your wife decided, and you just...
It was a family decision. She was right. But the joke was on me, James, because I immediately became a private equity CFO in Houston. So I was getting on a plane every week regardless, but we had home base where she and I wanted it to be.
Okay. This is part of the wider trend. You're probably a little bit earlier to it, but fractional CFOs, many people are taking this option because it gives them some modicum of control back over what they're doing. It's a role that's typically within the bowels of an organization. And now people have figured out after COVID, hey, hold on, doesn't necessarily need to be that way. And more firms are looking for fractional help. But private equity has long used fractional CFOs because it's very integral to what they're doing. So maybe you could just tell us, like, why do private equity firms in particular use fractional CFOs? Like, what makes them unique, or what makes them really need them more than other businesses?
Yeah, I want to make it clear too, a fractional CFO shop, a lot of people are using that term now because it's become fun marketing. Mm-hmm. A true CFO and controller shop is not your, I guess, said a different way. We are not a bookkeeping and block and tackle accounting manager shop, which a lot of fractional CFOs are marketing themselves thereof. We are a true PE CFO controller group. And so to your point, it's nice for a private equity firm. So a private equity firm of size has many port codes that they're trying to run successfully. So if they can find a shop like Halliwell's that has one, two, three, or four people that can come in, drop ship, there's no benefits paid, there's no long time commitment, we can drop in and out of port codes as needed for stress, for turnarounds, for new investments, for recurring deliverables on a standardized basis. It was a very easy drop in, drop out, which was Halliwell's MO. You call us tomorrow, we'll be there on Monday, only because you're not working the weekend. Get the job done, write the ship, document the processes and standardize, and get out. Mm-hmm. And we would do that across multiple PE firms on a recurring basis. And basically, we're trading board decks, we're standardizing deliverables, all of which PE firms needed anyway. And you're saving cost, you're saving time, and plug and play and keep going. I'll leave it there for now.
So PE firms are inherently financially minded anyway. They're doing investments, as I say. They're looking for businesses you can almost run from a spreadsheet, ideally. And that's where it's a different mindset often to the target customers who target acquisitions who may have not been that way at all. So is there any sort of sector of PE, like large, middle, or small, that you specialize in? Or is it any type of PE search fund that you work with?
No, we work with anything from self-funded search through to traditional search to PE to VC, all the way to some mid-cap SEC companies. But to your point, we get called for three things. There's a new investment, the person sitting in the seat doesn't have the firepower. There's been an error or a big miss, or heaven forbid, a fraud where we've got to come in and right the ship. Or it's a turnaround effort. There's been a distressed investment for some time. We're trying to right the ship, get it prepared for sale, and get out. So all that to answer your question, that we're fairly agnostic outside of healthcare and some larger not-for-profit businesses, because they tend to be fairly regulated and they don't have the same goals as a for-profit entity. But we're pretty prevalent oil and gas, tech, retail, SIPs, manufacturing, mostly nationwide in Canada and the UK. Anyone that needs a sound financial person, the adult in the room, I guess we call it the back office leader, depending on what deliverables you actually need, it's pretty analogous across the board.
So I, with a tech background, I've come from that. I read TechCrunch and the VC world news, if you like. And the big news from VC in the last sort of year or two after the ZIRP period is now over, a lot of VCs are retreating from the market. And there's a perception that PE is going to step in and maybe take some of these startup companies and probably try to bring them to a next level. But is that a little bit hopeful thinking on the part of those early investors in the tech sector? Would PE firms really, are they able to fill the gap that's been left by VC funds that are not in the market anymore?
Yeah, I don't want to speak broadly for the PE industry as a whole, especially as tech, but if you've gotten a tech to revenue viability, meaning it's not just sitting on the shelf and it's still being developed, there are certainly going to be a player there, because as we all know, the gross margins on tech are just that much higher than everybody else. If you can prove revenue, someone will step in. And VC to PE is a very natural trend anyway. I would think there would be some meat to what that market is saying.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see what happens, because all the VCs seem to have gone. And if you're not bootstrapped and if you are funded, then we'll see that play out over the next couple of years. But let's get back to a little bit about the work you do for these PE firms. So you mentioned turnaround situations, or you're looking at distressed investment opportunities. And a big part of that is quality of earnings estimation, or how do you describe it, or due diligence. Sure. So tell us a bit about that process, what it is, what do these terms mean?
Yeah, and it doesn't matter if it's distressed, in good position, and ready to sell. So quality of earnings is a marketing term for deal diligence, buy and sell side. You have a potential company or a group of companies, a conglomerate, an individual subsidiary, doesn't matter on size, that you're preparing for sale. So on the sell side, it's a lot of accounting cleanup, fixing all the errors, getting the add backs right. On the buy side, although it's not a CPA regulated set of procedures, you can essentially think of it as a shake of the trees, getting rid of some of that information asymmetry when you're in a deal to see if the numbers that you're predicating this deal on hold muster or pass muster. Mm-hmm. So for example, my team comes mostly from big four audit and large firm due diligence, meaning they're going to come in and do revenue testing, cash proofs, reconciliations to tax returns, detailed invoice testing to see if your purported EBITDA or customer acquisition cost, whatever the industry is, whatever the deal metric is based on, can be shown within a range to hold some kind of credibility. But again, just like an audit, there's no guarantees, but this is a very good way to see if the numbers hold true. And then to proceed in your negotiations, move to legal, move to close. But financial due diligence is the same thing as quality of earnings. It's just become a nice marketing term for the industry.
So maybe what sounds different to a standard audit from that perspective, it's not just verifying what's in the books is correct, but this is a little bit more stress testing. Is that it? So you're maybe coming up with your own hypotheses. It's a step beyond just verifying what's happening, but this is trying to figure out, look for risks. If we are thinking about, is this something that on the sell side, what's the benefit of doing this on the sell side rather than when a buyer is going to come in and going to want to look for their own sort of particular set of information anyway? How does that help if you are looking for acquisition and you want to get someone in to change your books?
So let's juxtapose the two. Let's say it's a large PE deal where iBanks or investment banks are involved. There's already buy and sell side diligence happening, even if there's already audited financials, meaning data room prep. So to put it in perspective, you're right. A CPA level audit review compilation is geared towards financial statement or accounting metrics. Quality earnings are geared towards deal metrics, EBITDA, add backs. What is the go forward EBITDA and or free cash flow that I can expect to generate?
Right.
So there's the difference. Now, in a big deal, you've already got buy and sell side diligence, and they often are the ones answering questions, getting to the bottom of issues, really hammering things down. And now it's become, even in small deals, a sell side Q of E in a small deal, let's say sub $20 million enterprise values, which used to be no man's land 10 to 15 years ago, but now people are writing check sizes, and there's an entire SBA program geared towards small ETA deals. A sell side Q of E in that space, although it may sound painful, gets all the accounting questions answered, gets things cleaned up, vouches out the add back so that when they go to sell, the process is that much smoother. They have something to back up the numbers because businesses of that size tend to not need an audit and or review unless they have some weird bank debt or any bank debt. Right. So not to say it's weird bank debt. The joke being a Q of E can get that much quicker to close as opposed to waiting until a buy side Q of E happens and getting blown up by a ton of questions and things that you may or may not have corrected that they're going to find anyway.
So. Sure. So the key word I heard there was add backs, right? That's the biggest area for, let's say, disagreement or what you want to be clear on. So for my standard, even we have audited accounts, but that's no use for, we don't talk about add backs in our audited accounts, and we don't talk about them in our management accounts either. So add backs is one big difference. Are there any other big differences between, let's say, my management accounts, my tax accounting, if you like?
No, so we're going to reconcile all three. So once you get to the accounting number in the financial statement accounts and the management accounts, get back to EBITDA, which is analogized to operating cash flows, and we can then get to free cash flow based on some accounting definitions. But you're not wrong. Add backs are the things that are happening within the business that a new buyer will either, it won't be recurring or just not necessary. Hmm. And there's a lot of back and forth on add backs because some businesses go to market knowing what they're doing and knowing that these are silly and we should be not doing these anyway. For example, personal owner expenses, the private jet, the new owner probably doesn't need, the things that make sense. Yeah. When it becomes contentious is when sellers try to pass off recurring charges as non-recurring. So for example, there's been a number of deals in 24 as interest rates got hot where people are still trying to get EBITDA ticked up, even broker-led deals where we're seeing EBITDA overinflated because of things like our bonuses aren't contractual, so we don't need to pay those. You won't need to pay those and go forward. Sure, your employment agreement doesn't have it, but go tell your senior team that you're going to need to keep EBITDA up for your earnout, they're not getting a bonus anymore. Do you really think it's not recurring? What a joke is that nonsense? So there's lots of those kind of examples that lead to renegotiations and retrades and or people walking away because the sim and or marketing materials and the numbers being thrown out there just can't be supported.
Hmm. And then on the other side, I guess, if you're on the buy side, I think we talked earlier about a story about how you have timesheets and whether people are actually internally even managing their own resources properly. So have you come across situations where you've discovered, hold on, this business could be doing way better than it actually is if you knew what was going on?
So we had you're right. There was a recent deal. It was a large construction company where very profitable, going to market, should be, they have retiring owners, all the right reasons. But there was a specific niche division within the business that had ridiculous cost of labor assigned to their projects. And this is a high-end labor group, should be doing better margins. So we got sent in there to investigate. We're doing the QV. And the woman I had put on it, she's an amazing auditor, called me the same day. And it's a deal in New Jersey. She said, Mike, you're not going to believe what we found. And I was like, they haven't found it in months. How did you find it so fast? She goes, you're not even going to believe it. So James, I know this is rhetorical. How many hours are there in a day?
Yeah, last time I checked, I think there's 24, yeah.
So when you see 40 hours of overtime in a day for individuals within the team, that's not possible.
Right.
So what had happened is they had a control where field supervisors had to sign off on overtime. The field supes and the team were pissed off. They weren't getting pay raises or something along those lines. We never found out. Everyone got fired. They didn't prosecute because they didn't want any mud on their face during the sale. But essentially, businesses can put in controls, but if they're not following them or monitoring them in some way, they don't matter. So these guys were signing off on overtime numbers that just didn't make any sort of sense and passing it off for payroll. So these are the kind of things that come out in diligence that they don't cease to surprise us, I guess is the point.
Okay. And then in that instance, it didn't kill the deal. They dealt with that in a sort of normal way and then went on.
But EBITDA actually went up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you asked me that question about how many hours in a day, I was wondering if you ask lawyers, because lawyers are notorious for a similar thing. The only difference is they have 10 different clients to build 3 hours a day each too. But I know there's a lot of text.
Yeah, this was blatant fraud, this one. It just, again.
And was it, just talking generally, was it that it were just like the supervisors were like good old boys keeping everyone happy? Or was this?
So just like in an audit, you can't prevent collusion. So if you have a control in place, but both groups have gotten together to get around the system to do something stupid to your business, those things happen, right? But someone should have been looking over the top, looking at the actual payroll reports going, you can't charge this. How in the world is this possible? Basically, we were told that this group had come to, it was a very specialized construction group, very good people as far as technical experience, came to the group, asked for pay raises. They didn't get everything they wanted. So they just figured out a way to get paid more. They would have been better off just asking again. They couldn't have lost these people. That's what came out later from HR was if they'd have just pushed us on pay, we'd have given it to them anyway. Now, operationally, it's tough once you're in the fog of running a business. But again, they took it upon themselves to do something quite stupid to the business that was paying them. And those happen more often than people think.
Yeah, it happens a lot, I think. And of course, you don't hear about it because just like in that situation, it's in no one's interest to make a big deal about it. We all just move on. And often what happens if those people who have done it in one business, they just move on to the next business and do it all over again and no one knows about it. And that's a common recurring theme. So I just want to ask you about something that you've done, which is for your own firm, you've done your own PE deal. Now, traditionally, a services business wouldn't have any enterprise value internally in it. It was just people's hours and people leave, then they walk out the door and there's no real point in buying that business unless you're going to merge it into something else. So how did you manage to position yourself to do your own PE firm to grow your own business?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. I didn't build Hollywell, and Hollywell certainly become bigger than Mike German. So we didn't build Hollywell to sell it. Mm-hmm. I quite like what I do. I liked coaching and mentoring at PwC. But when we got to a certain size, just like the other PE firms that are buying CPA firms, which has become a hot button, a very hot industry for PE, it became clear that because we'd done a lot of the deals or quality of earnings on some of the bigger PE roll-ups of CPE or CPA and professional service accounting firms, we started to get some interest. I wasn't having it. I didn't want anyone to control my destiny. I was 39 at the time. I'm 41 now. I didn't want anyone to take away what we'd built, especially because a lot of the people that came to Hollywell were from the big firms. I didn't want to go back to those firms because they quite like what we'd built for people and supporting. Not to say those, I love PwC, let's be clear. I'm not one of those people that vents about their big four firm. There's nowhere else I was going to get that training. And just like we joked, I would still be there if my wife would have said yes. So long story short, eventually someone came knocking that, to your point, wanted to purchase a majority interest of Hollywell, but then put us into a larger team of CPA firms, all trying to come together that have similar mindsets, similar skill sets, pragmatic, genuine client service focus. And we could not have been more happy with how it turned out. So let me give you an example. So typically, having grown up in PE offices, I was expecting the same, a handler to be assigned, new management team, lean out on expenses, new cadence, new reporting. We closed on this deal, and for 2 weeks after congratulatory notes and some scheduling of a fun trip to do as new PE owners together, I didn't hear from anybody, which is unheard of. I had to call them and say, hey, everything all right? What's going on? They were like, yeah, just keep doing what you're doing. Turns out we were purchased by a group of search fund legends that had already built and sold businesses a number of times that pooled their money. So they are very owner-operator supportive. So if the message to your group and to your audience is, make sure you feel good about your new owners, but if you can find a group like that is supportive and you're going to continue in the business, it's that much more accretive. Yeah. It's just a genuinely positive experience, which not everyone can say.
Well, I've heard that echoed by, you know, PE firm or any acquirer. This acquisition is unlikely to be their biggest acquisition. That would be silly from their perspective. They obviously make multiple investments. So when you're being acquired, it feels like the world is potentially ending or exploding or whatever, because it's your entire world. But to them, you're just one of six deals they're doing this year, or one of 6 year deals they're doing in the next 3 years, sure, or whatever. So you can, maybe the fear, I would have the exact same thing. What would happen on the number one, like, what would it be like if suddenly someone else is telling me what to do, or what to, how to format the board pack or whatever, and your worst fears come to the front. So I think it's probably a good reminder that it doesn't have to work out that way. You can actually find a good home. So is it still working that way to this day? You just keep on rocking like you were. Yeah. It's just that they're there to back you up in case.
Yeah, it's funny. I was quite adamant. I don't want any comms. I don't want anyone to know. I didn't want my team to feel any of that difference or change. And I didn't tell them for 3 or 4 months, and they went, oh, sure, that sounds good. They didn't even, nothing changed for the team, which was one of the bookends we wanted to make sure was put in place, and it still hasn't, other than some integrated payroll. It's, and me having, I'd volunteered to step up into a more of a managing partner role. It's gone quite well.
Okay. So you're, as I've heard before, your secret sauce in doing that deal was a lifelong servitude to customers, and then having a great network because you're good at what you do. Unfortunately, not very replicable for other people who are running.
Correct.
Fractional CFO businesses, but maybe the lesson there is maybe these opportunities come if you stick to the knitting and are in, aligned around what you want to do and focus on your clients. Not a sexy answer, but works.
I think everyone likes the success story, but there was 6 years of grinding, pain, lots of travel, standardizing, building things, just like you've experienced and a lot of your audience have experienced. Again, just keep your nose to the grind, and usually good things happen depending on where you want the path to go, but it certainly was a lot of tears and struggle there for a while.
Very good. Maybe you could just tell us a bit about who you've talked a little bit about how your ideal customer is and how people can get in touch with you if they think they might have some business for you.
Oh, sure. Guys, we're at info@hollywellpartners.com. It's spelled just the way you think it is, HOLLYWELL. I'm on X begrudgingly, but we're focused on anything from self-funded search through to private equity, meaning VC, traditional search, whether it's quality of earnings assessments or technical accounting or real accounting leadership, we're here to help. And it is very cost effective. And I can speak highly for the team and experiences our clients have had.
Very good. So as a final question, I'll ask you a question we ask all guests here, which is, who is your business hero and why?
Oh, it's actually a good lesson to anyone thinking about their own shop or their own journey. When I became a CFO, no one tells you how to be a CFO. And I was making the same mistakes I was counseling clients at PwC not to do. And luckily, one of the investors of one of my clients took me under his wing as my CFO mentor. He was a former investment banking legend that had done multiple PE exits as a private equity CFO himself. And he kept me grounded, showed me how to be more pragmatic, showed me how to be a bit more, don't try to win the argument, make sure you get to the victory as a group. Those kind of things go a long way. So find a mentor. Even if you're a jerk introvert like me, that mentorship meant a lot. Unfortunately, he got a terminal stomach cancer diagnosis in his early 70s and passed recently, but he was certainly someone, I still keep his obituary on the fridge, but I cannot speak highly enough for Mr. Buck Glenn Jones from Nashville, Tennessee. But
anyway, yeah, I'll leave it there. I love that. People love mentorship, and you don't need to, sometimes there's a temptation thing, I need to hire, or I want to get acquired so I can get advice, or I need to hire someone to get advice, but actually just finding someone and asking for them help, oftentimes they love talking to you, they love helping you, especially if they're a few steps ahead. I love it. Very good. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. If you're still listening to the podcast, your special reward is to go be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. I've got a nice little webinar there for you. Shows you how Procurement Express works with fractional CFOs to deliver enhanced cost control for their clients without having to buy an ERP. And Michael, this has been great. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jim. Really appreciate it.